lay awake in the little house, feeling the air stifling and the ceiling pressing down on her, then slept suddenly and deeply. She woke as suddenly when the east was just getting light. She went to the door to see what she loved best to see, the sky before sunrise. Looking down from it, she saw Asver the patterner, rolled up in his gray cloak, sound asleep on the ground before her doorstep. She withdrew noiselessly into the house. In a little while, she saw him going back to his woods, walking a bit stiffly and scratching his head as he went, as people do when half awake. She got to work scraping down the inner wall of the house, readying it to plaster. But before the sun was in the windows, there was a knock at her open door. Outside was the man she had thought was a gardener, the master herbal, looking solid and stolid, like a brown ox, beside the gaunt, grim-faced old namer. She came to the door and muttered some kind of greeting. They daunted her, these masters of Roke, and also their presence meant that the peaceful time was over, the days of walking in the silent summer forest with the patterner. That had come to an end last night. She knew it, but she did not want to know it. "The patterner sent for us," said the master herbal. He looked uncomfortable. Noticing a clump of weeds under the window, he said, "That's Velver. Somebody from Hamnor planted it here. Didn't know there was any on the island." He examined it attentively and put some seed pods into his pouch. Irian was studying the namer covertly, but equally attentively, trying to see if she could tell if he was a, what he had called, ascending, or was there in flesh and blood. Nothing about him appeared insubstantial, but she thought he was not there, and when he stepped into the slanting sunlight and cast no shadow, she knew it. "Is it a long way from where you live, sir?" she asked. He nodded.
"Left myself halfway," he said.
He looked up.
The patterner was coming towards them, wide awake now. He greeted them and asked, "The doorkeeper will come?"
"Said he thought he'd better keep the doors," said the herbal.
He closed his many-pocketed pouch carefully and looked around at the others.
"But I don't know if he can keep a lid on the anthill."
"What's up?" said Kurem Karmeruk. "I've been reading about dragons, not paying attention, but all the boys I had studying at the tower left."
"Summoned," said the herbal, dryly.
"So," said the namer, more dryly.
"I can tell you only how it seems to me," the herbal said, reluctant, uncomfortable.
"Do that," the old mage said.
The herbal still hesitated.
"This lady is not of our council," he said at last.
"She is of mine," said Asver. "She came to this place at this time," the namer said, "and to this place, at this time, no one comes by chance. All any of us knows is how it seems to us. There are names behind names, my lord healer."
The dark-eyed mage bowed his head at that and said, "Very well," evidently with relief at accepting their judgment over his own. "Thorian has been much with the other masters, and with the young men. Secret meetings, inner circles, rumors, whispers. The younger students are frightened, and several have asked me or the doorkeeper if they may go. And we'd let them go. But there's no ship in port, and none has come into Thwill Bay since the one that brought you, lady, and sailed again the next day for Wathort. The Wind Key keeps the Roke wind against all. If the king himself should come, he could not land on Roke."
"Until the wind changes, eh?" said the patterner.
"Thorian says Labannon is not truly king, since no archmage crowned him."
"Oh, nonsense! Not history," said the old namer. "The first archmage came centuries after the last king. Roke ruled in the king's stead."
"Ah," said the patterner.
Hard for the housekeeper to give up the keys when the owner comes home.
The ring of peace is healed, said the herbal, in his patient, troubled voice. The prophecy is fulfilled. The son of Morid is crowned, and yet we have no peace. Where have we gone wrong? Why can we not find the balance?
What does Thorian intend? Asked the namer.
To bring Labanan here, said the herbal. The young men talk of the true crown, a second coronation here, by the archmage Thorian.
Avert, Irian blurted out, making the sign to prevent word from becoming deed.
None of the men smiled,
and the herbal belatedly made the same gesture.
How does he hold them all? The namer said.
Herbal, you were here when Sparrowhawk and Thorian were challenged by Irioth. His gift was as great as Thorian's, I think. He used it to use men, to control them wholly. Is that what Thorian does?
I don't know, the herbal said. I can only tell you that when I'm with him, when I'm in the great house, I feel that nothing can be done but what has been done, that nothing will change, nothing will grow. No matter what cures I use, the sickness will end in death.
He looked around at them all like a hurt ox.
And I think it is true. There is no way to regain the equilibrium but by holding still. We have gone too far. For the Archmage and Labanan to go boldly into death and return, it was not right. They broke a law that must not be broken. It was to restore the law that Thorian returned.
What? To send them back into death, the namer said, and the patterner,
who is to say what is the law?
There is a wall, the herbal said.
That wall is not as deep-rooted as my trees, said the patterner. But you're right, herbal. We're out of balance, said Kurim Karmeruk, his voice hard and harsh. When and where did we begin to go too far? What have we forgotten, turned our back on, overlooked?
Irian looked from one to the other.
When the balance is wrong, holding still is not good. It must get more wrong, said the patterner. Until,
he made a quick gesture of reversal with his open hands, down going up and up down.
What's more wrong than to summon oneself back from death? Said the namer.
Thorian was the best of us all, a brave heart, a noble mind.
The herbal spoke almost in anger.
Sparrowhawk loved him. So did we all.
Conscience caught him, said the namer. Conscience told him he alone could set things right. To do it, he denied his death. So he denies life.
And who shall stand against him? Said the patterner.
I can only hide in my woods. And I in my tower, said the namer. And you, herbal, and the doorkeeper, are in the trap in the great house. The walls we built to keep all evil out. Or in, as the case may be.
We are four against him, said the patterner.
They are five against us, said the herbal. Has it come to this, the namer said, that we stand at the edge of the forest Sagoy planted to talk of how to destroy one another?
Yes, said the patterner. What goes too long unchanged destroys itself.
The forest is forever because it dies and dies. And so lives.
I will not let this dead hand touch me, or touch the king who brought us hope. A promise was made, made through me, I spoke it. A woman on Gaunt. I will not see that word forgotten.
Then should we go to Gaunt? said the herbal, caught in Asver's passion. Sparrowhawk is there.
Tenar of the Ring is there, said Asver.
Maybe our hope is there, said the Namer.
They stood silent, uncertain, trying to cherish hope. Irian stood silent too, but her hope sank down, replaced by a sense of shame and utter insignificance. These were brave men, wise men, seeking to save what they loved, but they did not know how to do it. And she had no share in their wisdom, no part in their decisions. She drew away from them, and they did not notice. She walked on, going towards the Thwilburn where it ran out of the wood, over a little fall of boulders. The water was bright in the morning sunlight, and made a happy noise. She wanted to cry, but she had never been good at crying. She stood and watched the water, and her shame turned slowly into anger. She came back towards the three men and said, Asver. He turned to her, startled, and came forward a little. Why did you break your rule for me? Was it fair to me, who can never be what you are? Asver frowned.
Well, the doorkeeper admitted you because you asked, he said. I brought you to the grove because the leaves of the trees spoke your name to me before you ever came here.
Irian, they said. Irian.
Why you came, I don't know, but not by chance. The summoner, too, knows that. Maybe I came to destroy him.
He looked at her and said nothing.
Maybe I came to destroy Roke. His pale eyes blazed then. Try.
A long shudder went through her as she stood facing him. She felt herself larger than he was. Larger than she was. Enormously larger. She could reach out one finger and destroy him. He stood there, in his small, brave, brief humanity, his mortality, defenseless. She drew a long, long breath. She stepped back from him. The sense of huge strength was draining out of her. She turned her head a little and looked down, surprised to see her own brown arm, her rolled-up sleeve, the grass springing cool and green around her sandaled feet. She looked back at the patterner, and he still seemed a fragile being. She pitied and honored him. She wanted to warn him of the peril he was in, but no words came to her at all. She turned round and went back to the stream bank by the little falls. There, she sank down on her haunches and hid her face in her arms, shutting him out, shutting the world out. The voices of the mages talking were like the voices of the stream running. The stream said its words, and they said theirs, but none of them were the right words. When Asver rejoined the other man, there was something in his face that made the herbal say, "What is it?"
I don't know, he said. Maybe we should not leave Roke. Probably we can't, said the herbal, if the wind key locks the winds against us. I'm going back to where I am, Kurem Kamaruk said abruptly. I don't like leaving myself about like an old shoe. I'll join you this evening. And he was gone.
I'd like to walk under your trees a bit, Asver, the herbal said with a long sigh.
Go on, Dayala. I'll stay here.
The herbal went off. Asver sat down on the rough bench Irian had made and put against the front wall of the house. He looked upstream at her, crouching motionless on the bank. Sheep, in the field between them and the great house, blatted softly. The morning sun was getting hot.
His father had named him Banner of War. He had come west, leaving all he knew behind him, and had learned his true name from the trees of the imminent grove, and became the Patterner of Roke. All this year, the patterns of the shadows and the branches and the roots, all the silent language of his forest, had spoken of destruction, of transgression, of all things changed. Now it was upon them, he knew. It had come with her. She was in his charge, in his care. He had known that when he saw her. Though she came to destroy Roke, as she has said, he must serve her. He did so willingly. She had walked with him in the forest, tall, awkward, fearless. She had put aside the thorny arms of brambles with her big, careful hand. Her eyes, amber-brown like the water of the Thwilburn in shadow, had looked at everything. She had listened. She had been still. He wanted to protect her, and knew he could not. He had given her a little warmth when she was cold. He had nothing else to give her. Where she must go, she would go. She did not understand danger. She had no wisdom but her innocence, no armor but her anger. "Who are you, Irian?" he said to her, watching her crouch there like an animal locked in its muteness. His friend came back from the woods and sat down beside him on the bench for a while. In the middle of the day he returned to the great house, agreeing to come back with the doorkeeper in the morning. They would ask all the other masters to meet with them in the grove. "But he won't come," Diyala said, and Asver nodded. All day he stayed near the otter's house, keeping watch on Irian, making her eat a little with him. She came to the house, but when they had eaten, she went back to her place on the stream bank and sat there motionless. He too felt a lethargy in his own body and mind, a stupidity which he fought against but could not shake off. He thought of the summoner's eyes, and then it was he that felt cold, cold through, though he was sitting in the full heat of the summer's day. "We are ruled by the dead," he thought. The thought would not leave him. He was grateful to see Kurem Karmeruk coming slowly down the bank of the Thwilburn from the north. The old man waded through the stream barefoot, holding his shoes in one hand and his tall staff in the other, snarling when he missed his footing on the rocks. He sat down on the near bank to dry his feet and put his shoes back on. "When I go back to the tower," he said, "I'll ride, hire a carter, buy a mule. I'm old, Asver." "Come up to the house," the patterner said, and he set out water and food for the namer.
"Where's the girl?"
"Asleep." Asver nodded towards where she lay, curled up in the grass above the little falls. The heat of the day was beginning to lessen, and the shadows of the grove lay across the grass, though the otter's house was still in sunlight. Kurem Karmeruk sat on the bench, with his back against the house wall, and Asver on the doorstep.
"We've come to the end of it,"
the old man said out of silence. Asver nodded in silence.
"What brought you here, Asver?" the namer asked. "I've often thought of asking you. A long, long way to come. And you have no wizards in the Kargish lands, I think."
"No, but we have the things wizardry is made of. Water, stones, trees, words."
"But not the words of the making?"
"No, nor dragons."
"Never?"
"Only in some very, very old tales, before the gods were,
before men were.
Before men were men, they were dragons."
"Now that is interesting," said the old scholar, sitting up straighter.
I told you I was reading about dragons. You know, there's been talk of them flying over the inmost sea, as far east as Gaunt.
That was no doubt Kalesin taking Ged home, multiplied by sailors making a good story better.
But a boy swore to me that his whole village had seen dragons flying this spring, westward of Mount On. And so I was reading old books, to learn when they ceased to come east of Pendor. And in one, I came on your story, or something like it, that men and dragons were all one kind, but they quarreled. Some went west and some east, and they became two kinds, and forgot they were ever one.
We went farthest east, Asver said. But do you know what the leader of an army is, in my tongue?
Edron, said the Namer promptly, and laughed. Drake. Dragon.
After a while he said, I could chase an etymology on the brink of doom. But I think, Asver, that's where we are.
We won't defeat him.
He has the advantage, Asver said, very dry.
He does. So therefore, admitting it unlikely, admitting it impossible, if we did defeat him,
if he went back into death and left us here alive, what would we do? What comes next?
After a long time, Asver said, I have no idea.
Your leaves and shadows tell you nothing.
Change, change, said the patterner. Transformation.
He looked up suddenly. The sheep, who had been grouped near the stile, were scurrying off, and someone was coming along the path from the great house.
A group of young men, said the herbal, breathless, as he came to them. Thorian's army, coming here, to take the girl, to send her away.
He stood and drew breath.
The doorkeeper was speaking with them when I left, I think.
Here he is, said Asver, and the doorkeeper was there, his smooth, yellowish-brown face tranquil as ever.
I told them, he said, that if they went out Medra's gate this day, they'd never go back through it into a house they knew. Some of them were for turning back then, but the Windkey and the Chanter urged them on. They'll be along soon.
They could hear men's voices in the fields east of the grove. Asver went quickly to where Irian lay beside the stream, and the others followed him. She roused up and got to her feet, looking dull and dazed. They were standing around her, a kind of guard, when the group of 30 or more men came past the little house and approached them. They were mostly older students. There were 5 or 6 wizard staffs among the crowd, and the Master Windkey led them. His thin, keen old face looked strained and weary, but he greeted the 4 mages courteously by their titles. They greeted him, and Asver took the word.
Come into the grove, Master Windkey, he said, and we will wait there for the others of the 9.
First we must settle the matter that divides us, said the Windkey. That is a stony matter, said the Namer.
The woman with you defies the rule of Roke, the Windkey said. She must leave. A boat is waiting at the dock to take her, and the wind, I can tell you, will stand fair for way.
I have no doubt of that, my lord, said Asver, but I doubt she will go.
My lord Patterner, will you defy our rule and our community, that has been one so long, upholding order against the forces of ruin? Will it be you, of all men, who break the pattern?
It is not glass to break, Asper said. It is breath. It is fire.
It cost him a great effort to speak.
It does not know death, he said.
But he spoke in his own language, and they did not understand him. He drew closer to Irian. He felt the warmth of her body. She stood staring, silent as an animal,
as if she did not understand any of them.
"Lord Thorian has returned from death to save us all," the Wind Key said, fiercely and clearly. "He will be Archmage. Under his rule, Roke will be as it was. The king will receive the true crown from his hand and rule with his guidance, as Morrid ruled. No witches will defile sacred ground. No dragons will threaten the inmost sea. There will be order, safety, and peace."
None of the mages answered him. In the silence, the men with him murmured, and a voice among them said,
"Let us have the witch."
"No," Asver said, but could say nothing else. He held his staff of green willow, but it was only wood in his hand. Of the four of them, only the doorkeeper moved and spoke. He took a step forward, looking from one young man to the next, and the next. He said, "You trusted me, giving me your names. Will you trust me now?"
"My lord," said one of them, with a fine dark face and a wizard's oaken staff, "we do trust you, and therefore ask you to let the witch go, and peace return."
Irion stepped forward before the doorkeeper could answer.
"I am not a witch," she said.
Her voice sounded high, metallic, after the men's deep voices.
"I have no art, no knowledge. I came to learn." "We do not teach women here," said the Wind Key. "You know that."
"I know nothing," Irion said. She stepped forward again, facing the mage directly.
"Tell me who I am. Learn your place, woman," the mage said with cold passion.
"My place," she said, slowly, the words dragging.
"My place is on the hill, where things are what they are. Tell the dead man I will meet him there."
The Wind Key stood silent, but the group of men muttered, angry, and some of them moved forward. Asver came between her and them, her words releasing him from the paralysis of mind and body that had held him.
"Tell Thorian we will meet him on Roke Knoll," he said. "When he comes, we will be there."
"Now come with me," he said to Irion. The Namer, the doorkeeper, and the herbal followed him, with her, into the grove. There was a path for them, but when some of the young men started after them, there was no path.
"Come back," the Wind Key said to the men.
They turned back, uncertain. The low sun was still bright on the fields and the roofs of the great house, but inside the wood, it was all shadows.
"Witchery," they said. "Sacrilege. Defilement." "Best come away," said the Master Wind Key, his face set and somber, his keen eyes troubled.
He set off back to the school, and they straggled after him, arguing and debating in frustration and anger. They were not far inside the grove, and still beside the stream, when Irion stopped, turned aside, and crouched down by the enormous hunching roots of a willow that leaned out over the water. The four mages stood on the path.
"She spoke with the other breath," Asver said.
The Namer nodded.
"So we must follow her?"
the herbal asked. This time the doorkeeper nodded. He smiled faintly and said,
"So it would seem."
"Very well," said the herbal, with his patient, troubled look.
And he went aside a little and knelt to look at some small plant or fungus on the forest floor. Time passed, as always in the grove, not passing at all, it seemed, yet gone, the day gone quietly by in a few long breaths, a quivering of leaves, a bird singing far off, and another answering it from even farther. Irian stood up slowly. She did not speak, but looked down the path, and then walked down it. The four men followed her. They came out into the calm, open evening air. The west still held some brightness as they crossed the Thwilburn and walked across the fields to Roke Knoll, which stood up before them in a high dark curve against the sky.
"They're coming," the doorkeeper said.
Men were coming through the gardens and up the path from the great house. All the mages, many of the students. Leading them was Thorian the summoner, tall in his gray cloak, carrying his tall staff of bone-white wood, about which a faint gleam of ware-light hovered. Where the two paths met and joined, to wind up to the heights of the knoll, Thorian stopped and stood waiting for them. Irian strode forward to face him.
"Irian of Way," the summoner said in his deep, clear voice. "That there may be peace and order, and for the sake of the balance of all things, I bid you now leave this island. We cannot give you what you ask, and for that we ask your forgiveness. But if you seek to stay here, you forfeit forgiveness, and must learn what follows on transgression."
She stood up, almost as tall as he, and as straight. She said nothing for a minute, and then spoke out in a high, harsh voice.
"Come up onto the hill, Thorian," she said.
She left him standing at the way meet, on the level ground, and walked up the hill path for a little way, a few strides. She turned and looked back down at him.
"What keeps you from the hill?" she said.
The air was darkening around them. The west was only a dull red line. The eastern sky was shadowy above the sea. The summoner looked up at Irian. Slowly, he raised his arms and the white staff, in the invocation of a spell, speaking in the tongue that all the wizards and mages of Roke had learned, the language of their art, the language of the making.
"Irian, by your name I summon you and bind you to obey me."
She hesitated, seeming for a moment to yield, to come to him, and then cried out,
"I am not only Irian."
At that, the summoner ran up towards her, reaching out, lunging at her as if to seize and hold her. They were both on the hill now. She towered above him impossibly, fire breaking forth between them, a flare of red flame in the dusk air, a gleam of red gold scales, of vast wings. Then that was gone, and there was nothing there but the woman standing on the hill path, and the tall man bowing down before her, bowing slowly down to earth, and lying on it. Of them all, it was the herbal, the healer, who was the first to move. He went up the path and knelt down by Thorian.
"My lord," he said, "my friend."
Under the huddle of the gray cloak, his hands found only a huddle of clothes, and dry bones, and a broken staff.
"This is better, Thorian," he said,
but he was weeping. The old namer came forward and said to the woman on the hill,
"Who are you?" "I do not know my other name," she said.
She spoke as he had spoken, as she had spoken to the summoner, in the language of the making, the tongue that dragons speak. She turned away and began to walk on up the hill.
"Irian," said Asver the Patterner,
Will you come back to us?
She halted and let him come up to her.
I will, if you call me, she said.
She reached out and touched his hand. He drew his breath sharply.
Where will you go? He said.
To those who will give me my name. In fire, not water. My people. In the west, he said. She said, beyond the west. She turned away from him and them and went on up the hill in the gathering darkness. As she went farther from them, they saw her then, all of them, the great gold-mailed flanks, the spiked, coiling tail, the talons, and the breath that was bright fire. On the crest of the knoll, she paused a while, her long head turning to look slowly round the Isle of Roke, gazing longest at the grove, only a blur of darkness in darkness now. Then, with a rattle like the shaking of sheets of brass, the wide, veined wings opened, and the dragon sprang up into the air. Circled Roke Knoll once, and flew. A curl of fire. A wisp of smoke drifted down through the dark air. Asver the Patterner stood with his left hand holding his right hand, which her touch had burnt. He looked down at the men who stood silent at the foot of the hill, staring after the dragon. Well, my friends, he said, what now? Only the doorkeeper answered. He said, I think we should go to our house and open its doors.
Hi, this is Harlan Ellis, and I'm the creative consultant for Fantastic Audio, and I've been pressed into service to have a small commentary as postlogue, epilogue, as you wish, to Ursula K. Le Guin's wonderful collection of stories, which you have just heard, presumably, and to talk about Ursula, because she's an old pal of mine, the Countess Le Guin, who swears she's a vampire. She isn't really. She's actually one of the most elegant, strong women I have ever met, but she comes from very fine stock. The apple did not fall very far from that tree, because the tree was Theodora K. and Alfred L. Kroeber. That's K-R-O-E-B-E-R. You could look them up in almost any good guide to important literature, and you will find that in 1962 they published a book called Is She in Two Worlds? And this is the classic biography of the man Ishi, the last of his tribe, the Yahi people, who were believed massacred sometime between 1900 and 1911. And in 1911, he staggered into a slaughterhouse in northeastern California, and the Krobers did his biography. It's been made into a movie several times. I believe one of them was called Ishi, the Last of His Tribe. It's an astonishing book, and taught in hundreds of universities. Well, their daughter is Ursula K. for Krober Le Guin. Now, Ursula's first book was called Rokanan's World. It was a paperback. It was half of a double, an ace double. Ace books back in those days, which I guess was in about the mid-50s, early 60s, were doing these doubles. They would bind two books back to back. And on the back of Ursula's book, Rokanan's World, was a wonderful novel by Tom Dish called Mankind on the Leash, which was Donald Wolheim's retitling of Tom's original title, which was The Puppies of Terror, which is a marvelously mordant title. But here was Ursula K. Le Guin, this person no one had ever heard of before, and all of a sudden, she was leaping right into the forefront of the finest writers of science fiction and fantasy who had ever existed. She's married a man named Charles, and she's had 18 novels published. I mean, that's only the tip of the iceberg of the number of books she's done, but 18 novels. And I'm not sure this will encapsulate her character for you, but I must tell you that Ursula and I have been together in enough. I mean, I had her baby. She said, I'm not to tell you what we did with it, but I did carry to term her baby. And we've found ourselves in any number of world capitals together, either speaking on the same venue or just happening to pass through at the same time. And the best one of those was maybe 20-something years ago, when I, in company with a woman long before I married Susan, and Charles and Ursula decided they wanted to go to my favorite tandoori restaurant, which was a few blocks over from Ladbroke Grove in Kensington. And we were walking. Ursula remembers that I fell down in the Portobello Hotel, that I threw myself to the floor and tried to swim across the carpet. She swears this is true. I have no memory of it. And the woman is a liar. The woman is not true. But in any case, we were walking along this street beyond Ladbroke Grove toward this wonderful tandoori restaurant, and there was a large fire hydrant there. And for some reason, which I cannot recall now, I flung myself onto this fire hydrant and began begging it to take me to its leader. Ursula grabbed me by the legs and tried to drag me off it. No, no, I'm screaming. No, no, they're after us. You must listen to me. Take me to your leader. Her husband, Charles, as Ursula says, walked away very quietly, pretending he did not know either of us. And the next thing I knew, Ursula had dragged me off, and she was apologizing to the fire hydrant that I was not, in fact, a representative of our species, that she had no idea who I was, where I had come from, and please don't destroy our planet, because he's a fool. I have no idea how this will sit with you, these revelations about the Countess Lequac, but there you go. It's part of the joy of being a world-famous author is to know other totally demented world-famous authors. Thank you, and have a pleasant day.
Tales of Earthsea by Ursula K. Le Guin is a fantastic audio production. Performed by Scott Brick, Gabrielle DeCure, Amanda Carr, Stefan Rudnicki, and the author. Produced and directed by Stefan Rudnicki. Recorded at Studio Zero in Van Nuys, California. Engineered by John Baker. Edited, mixed, and mastered by Kirk Miller Digital. Copyright 2001, American Audio Literature.